It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Michael Camerata, who is a cardiologist practicing here at Boca with Bartzokas, Rubenstein, and Servos Group. He grew up in Southwest Florida and attended the University of Miami, graduating with honors in 2004 with a degree in biology. He then went to medical school at the University of Florida in Gainesville, so he's a hurricane and a gator, where he was awarded the Jules Chapman Scholarship for Academic Excellence in Humanism. He then did his internship and residency at the University of North Carolina in internal medicine, and then subsequently did a combined research and clinical cardiology fellowship at Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. While he was there, he completed a Master of Science degree in Clinical and Population Translational Sciences through Wake Forest. After he did his general cardiology fellowship, he then began a fellowship in interventional cardiology at Wake Forest, where he then trained in all of the interventional cardiac procedures. This morning he's going to give us a talk on non-ST elevation ACS.
Morning. So the actual topic they asked me to cover was acute coronary syndromes, which to me just seemed like asking a gastroenterologist to talk about all GI bleeding. You probably couldn't fit it all within an hour. And so given that ST elevation ACS is a little bit more defined and sort of has preset pathways, there's not a lot of questions about where you should go or what you should do with it, the diagnostic testing and things like that, I figured I would focus in on non-ST elevation ACS. And we have sort of a diverse population of people in the room, from emergency physicians to my much senior partner in cardiology. So while this may bore some people, we have the benefit of having some of the residents. So I'm going to try and address some of the knowledge gaps that we've identified in the residency program in order to sort of help them out a little bit more. Thank you for showing up, Dr. Servos. So I'd like to start off with a case presentation, and this is an actual patient, not done at this emergency department, so you don't have to worry, Dr. Lehman. We're okay. This is at a different emergency department. But a 65-year-old gentleman, history of coronary disease with a stent placed several years back, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, sort of most of the patients that come in here. The only difference between this patient, what we typically see here, is that 6 should probably be a 9 for Boca Raton. The patient comes in with chest pressure, substernal, radiating to the left arm, jaw, similar to his prior MI. We've all heard this story at least 100 times. And he's seen in the emergency department, then called up to a resident service on the floor for admission. In the emergency department, he was given nitroglycerin. His chest pain was relieved, but only after he was given 4 milligrams of IV morphine. His initial troponin was 6.8. This is his EKG, which I could pick on Dr. Casal down here because he's sitting there looking at me funny, but I'll just go through it. You can see that there's sort of these diffuse ST changes, elevations in AVR, and it just sort of gives you this heebie-jeebie clinical picture about what might be going on. Again, there's no ST elevations, frankly, on here, so you wouldn't call this an ST elevation ACS. Patient's chest pain free by the time they arrive on the floor. So part of what we would want to go over is what antiplatelet therapy is most appropriate for this patient up front and then ongoing afterwards. What could have been better done on the front end in terms of the emergency department management before the patient was called into a resident service? What antianginals are appropriate or inappropriate in the patient population? If the patient does go on to receive PCI, should different antiplatelet agents be used at that time than are used up front? And what do the guidelines say about managing this patient? You'll have to excuse any spelling errors. My 4-year-old found my laptop intriguing, and so there may be letters plugged into any word. These are our ACC-AHA levels of evidence, and the reason that I show this slide is just sort of categorize this. You know, there's class 1, 2A, 2B, 3, and I like to sort of put this in different terms. This is must do, should do, could do with qualifications and should not do. That's generally the way to look at these things, and then the level of evidence. So starting off, if you're going to talk about acute coronary syndrome, you probably ought to define it and know what you're talking about. The definition, based on where you're looking, talks about a spectrum of clinical conditions compatible with acute myocardial ischemia or infarction, usually due to an abrupt decrease in coronary blood flow. For non-ST elevation ACS, this encompasses all of that minus ST elevation MIs, so basically unstable angina and non-ST elevation MIs. The traditional thought process and the pathogenesis of these syndromes is lipid-laden plaque, unstable plaque forming thrombus, which is an abrupt occlusion of a vessel. And usually in the non-ST elevation ACS categories, this is a subtotal occlusion. So you haven't lost complete blood flow most of the time, but it does lead to myocardial tissue damage and or threat of damage. These are just pathologic slides, and since we're not talking about ST elevation, we will remove that portion of it to show, again, thrombus in a coronary with extra space there where blood can flow through, causing symptoms. So the initial evaluation and sort of looking into the patient comes into the emergency department, what do you do? How do you classify this patient? How do you know if this patient is truly an ACS versus just bogus chest pain versus musculoskeletal chest pain, GI stuff? There are a multitude of different scores, different classification tools that can be used. The most prominent of which I think most of you have heard of, the TIMI risk score, the GRACE risk score, and the HEART score. The HEART score was actually developed at Wake Forest when I was a fellow there, so this is one of the newer scores. And there's a couple of minor differences between these. The TIMI risk score talks about people who you have already identified as having ACS. This risk score really doesn't apply to people who are just coming in. It doesn't help you differentiate people with chest pain into different categories of chest pain. But this really differentiates people into high-risk ACS, low-risk ACS. And it includes a multitude of factors, including cardiac risk factors, known coronary disease, aspirin use, ongoing chest pain, ST changes, biomarkers. The GRACE score is similar to that. There's a little bit more involvement in terms of calculating it, but again, it sort of categorizes people that you have already determined are having an acute coronary syndrome into high or low risk. Where the HEART score differs is that this is designed to be used up front to help you determine to some degree if this is likely to be ACS, so it sort of helps you differentiate people into the ACS pathways. And it involves classic history, EKGs, age, risk factors, and initial troponin elevation. All of these different scores have online calculators or, you know, various different things, which you would need for the GRACE score, since each one of these different variables has entirely different point systems and things like that. As many of the residents who have rotated on service with me can attest to, I'm sort of a stickler for knowing what an MI is, what is the way that you define somebody having an acute myocardial infarction, and there is published guidelines to help you, the third universal definition of MI, which has been out for some time, which basically defines biomarker elevation, specifically cardiac troponin, in the setting of symptoms likely to be ischemic. So this doesn't count for somebody having what you think is non-cardiac chest pain. EKG changes, echo abnormalities, wall motion, and my personal favorite here is for defining an MI, the autopsy right here. So if you find an MI on autopsy, you've probably missed the boat, but I just love that they keep it in the definition here. And then above and beyond that, there's multiple different kinds of MI. And this is where non-ST elevation ACS becomes very, very tricky. what we generally think of as spontaneous myocardial infarction. This is thrombus formation, plaque rupture. But you also have to remember that stable coronary disease in the setting of stress can lead to troponin elevations and symptoms. Anemia, these sorts of things, can all be lumped into a type 2 MI, which is due to demand-supply mismatch. And then there's multiple different categories, including post-PCI, and then generally sudden cardiac death is lumped in here, and then MI related to bypass surgery. So when the patient comes in, you're wanting to look at early risk stratification, and really just going through some of the guidelines, and these were most recently updated in 2014, so we're probably due for a guideline update in the near future. But you want to make sure that the patient gets an EKG on arrival. That's sort of a no-duh. You want to be able to classify them as a STEMI if they're coming in versus a non-STEMI. You want serial EKGs on the patient in the emergency department. You want troponins. And you want to measure these troponins 3 and 6 hours after the onset of symptoms. Here's the class one indication to use those risk scores that we talked about earlier, and you don't have to use all of them, but one of them would be reasonable. The risk stratification models again. And then if there's any questions, you may want to use additional EKG techniques. Or continuous ECG, although I don't think I've ever seen continuous 12-lead ECG being done in the history of clinical practice. This is one of those you could, but you better do it with qualifications because I think that this is a very time-consuming thing. And then one thing that I always find interesting is using the BNP to risk stratify someone with suspected ACS. I don't think we typically do that, but I think what they're getting at here is looking for somebody who may be hemodynamically unstable or going into cardiogenic shock. Looking at the biomarkers, the troponins, the cutoff for these usually for diagnosing an MI is above the 90th percentile. You want to consider sort of the time of presentation of onset of the symptoms and whatnot. Troponin elevations, they say, are useful for short and long-term prognosis. I think that's sort of needless to be said, but it is here in the guidelines, so it's something that needs to be done. Reassessment of the troponin on day 3 or 4, this is a 2B recommendation. I always found this interesting because most places, if you have someone coming in with a non-ST elevation MI, the national average length of stay is somewhere in about the 2-day range. So this is saying you should bring people back in the office and recheck their troponin. But again, this is one of those 2B, you could, but you ought to have some qualifications for it. When the patient initially comes in, you need to know exactly how to take care of them, especially from an internal medicine standpoint. Your cardiologist is not always going to be right at the bedside to help you with this. You want to observe the patient, make sure they have symptoms observe patients with symptoms consistent with ACS, but that don't have objective data of MI. So this is somebody who's coming in with what sounds like typical symptoms, but they don't have EKG changes. They haven't had a positive troponin, and you're trying to make sure that this patient is stable, and you want to watch them. The real question everyone has is, when is a stress test or a non-invasive modality appropriate in patients? And we'll get to that in a second. CTAs are very useful, especially in the ER in patients who are at very low risk. And then everyone who comes through should have aspirin, nitro, beta blocker at least ordered for them. Oxygen's important, the nitroglycerin, as we already talked about. Beta blockers, class one indication here for the first 24 hours in the absence of heart failure or low output state. The use of the heart failure-based beta blockers is important for people with stabilized heart failure, reduced ejection fraction, and then just reevaluating the patients to make sure they don't have contraindications to beta blockers. They're also reasonable. You should start them in patients with normal LV function, even in patients with normal LV function that have non-ST elevation ACS. One thing that most people don't typically think about are calcium channel blockers. And especially the AV nodal blocking calcium channel blockers, the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, can be a useful adjunct for patients with contraindications to beta blocker. And that's sort of where these play in, is in terms of anti-anginals up front in the absence of the ability to use beta blocker medication. You always want to make sure you're checking the risk factors, cholesterol, initiating high-intensity statins. And this is one guideline that I would like to go into a little bit further, and this is the use of IV morphine, which I see used very, very frequently in terms of people coming in, chest pain. They've gone through three nitros. They get a dose of morphine. Now they're chest pain-free. What do you do with that patient? You've now given them morphine. They're feeling better. But what does this mean for the patient? And there are some studies looking at this. The Crusade Quality Improvement Initiative actually looked at 57,000+ patients with non-ST elevation ACS. A total of 17,000 of these received IV morphine in the emergency department. And this compared patients who received morphine to patients who received nitroglycerin, and patients who received both looked at emergency setting at 400+ centers in the United States. So this is a pretty applicable study, although it is a retrospective analysis. It gives us some pretty important topics to talk about. The outcomes here are astounding. In patients who did not receive morphine, lower death rate, almost a full percentage point with appropriate adjusted odds ratios. Death or MI is lower in the no morphine group. So basically, you're looking at this morphine group and saying, wow, if you got morphine, you did a whole heck of a lot worse. And this is shown by the forest plot here. Really, there is no place where morphine is better. And in almost every category, CHF, no CHF, not having hypotension, positive cardiac biomarkers, negative cardiac biomarkers, ST depression, no ST depression, all of these age categories, people categorically did worse if they had to get morphine. And this is, again, the outcomes, and this was comparing nitroglycerin to morphine, and now you're going to see that the people that did well with nitroglycerin, had chest pain relief, did not have to go on to IV morphine. We're talking about major reductions in death. Post-admission MI was not significant, although it was borderline. Combine the two, death or MI, cardiogenic shock, CHF, all these things, the patients who did not receive morphine seemed to do better. So, you know, one would ask themselves, why is that? Is morphine actually causing the problem, or is morphine more of a marker of a much sicker patient? And so, you know, the classification of the recommendation is a 2B. You could give morphine, but you should probably have some qualifications to that. For instance, if you've given nitroglycerin and the pain is not relieved and you have to move on to giving morphine, this is a much sicker patient, and probably medically managing this patient overnight, it may not be in the patient's best interest. So from a resident, internist sort of perspective, or even the emergency department, if you're having to give morphine in a patient who has sort of typical ACS sorts of symptoms, this may be a patient that's more likely to need to go to the lab urgently and undergo PCI, because this is somebody who may not do well for you, and this is probably a marker of that. So this is just recapping everything that we just sort of went over, how all that plays in. Moving on to further management, ACE inhibitors and ARBs. These should be started on any patient with an LVEF less than 40%, and I think that's needless to be said, because that's part of the heart failure guidelines, regardless of whether you're here for a non-ST elevation ACS or not. ACEs are generally the preferred first-line agent, ARBs for those who are ACE intolerant, and then aldosterone blockade in patients post-MI without significant renal dysfunction. This is spironolactone. whose EF is less than 40%. They may also be reasonable in all patients with cardiac or vascular disease, but again, this is class 2A, so you probably should, but there's probably other therapy you should initiate first to make sure that the patient's going to tolerate those prior to starting the ACE inhibitors. As of 2014, the guidelines were changed in terms of categorizing and treating patients coming in through the emergency department with these ACS-type syndromes. And it broke them down into the emergent, the urgent or immediate invasive strategy, which are typically your ST elevation MIs, your non-ST elevation MIs in patients with ongoing symptoms that the pathway is easily recognized. This person needs to go to the cath lab, bring them in, take care of their underlying etiology. Where we're going to talk a little bit further is in the early invasive and ischemia-guided therapy. The ischemia-guided therapy pathway is really sort of your low-risk ACS patient. This is the person that's coming in. They've got some typical atypical features. It's more likely to be low-risk unstable angina. And I say that because when you sort of look at how this goes through, you'll notice that the invasive pathway is then initiated, so meaning you're going to take the patient to the cath lab within 24 hours, if you have signs of ischemia, which is despite initial medical therapy, so calling a failure of therapy. For anyone having refractory angina or angina after at rest after the therapy, any evidence of ischemia, so this includes EKG changes or a positive stress test, or the high TIMI or GRACE scores, you're sort of going to, again, risk stratify this person into a higher risk category. This is going to be somebody who should undergo invasive management right off the bat. This was really intended to avoid the routine use of invasive procedures in patients who would ultimately not require them or not benefit from PCI. So, if there is severe ischemia on a non-invasive study, if there's something that makes you think, okay, this is probably a higher risk patient, somebody that's actually having a major syndrome, and it was probably intended to help keep patients with, low risk chest pain, maybe stable angina that are coming in through the emergency department who hadn't been appropriately medically managed as an outpatient from undergoing PCI, which is intended for symptom improvement, when they hadn't been initially tried on medical management therapy. The early invasive pathway is what most of us are much more familiar with. These are your high-grade unstable angina or non-ST elevation MI patients. They have higher immediate risk scores. They are designated for cardiac catheterization, and the initial management is very similar to the ischemia-guided therapy in terms of medical management up front. This is just a group of patients that's intended to go to the cath lab within 24 hours. So when you look at the different classifications of these types of patients, you'll see that basically they stratify out pretty easily. Intermediate risk is delayed invasive therapy. This is one that we don't typically talk about, but these are generally people who started out in the ischemia-guided strategy and then converted over to an invasive strategy. High-risk patients are already queued in for invasive strategy, and the emergent patients have bypassed us completely and gone straight to the cath lab. This is a class one recommendation to go through this process of sort of categorizing people and placing them in these pathways. The urgent and immediate invasive strategy is indicated for the patients with refractory angina, hemodynamic or electrical instability. This gets back to patients who maybe now have an elevated BNP, something we don't typically check up front for patients with non-ST elevation ACS. The early invasive strategy is indicated in initially stabilized patients who have elevated risk for clinical events. Again, the elevated troponin, or they specifically mention the GRACE and TIMI scores, but not the heart score. So we should all be very familiar with these pathways. Early invasive strategy should be used over a delayed strategy for initially stabilized high-risk patients. We already sort of went through that a little bit. And then initially stabilized patients may be considered for ischemia-guided strategy if they're elevated risk for clinical events. And no one ever really defines that, but really, I mean, we should be using the GRACE and TIMI scores. I'm going to try and hammer that home today. And then after considering clinical and patient preference. So this is the patient who says, well, I'm 95. Why are you going to do a heart cath on me? Yeah, I know I may have had a little heart attack, but please leave me alone. Just treat me with medications. I've lived my life. And there is no benefit to an early invasive strategy in patients with the extensive comorbidities. So these are your cancer patients, patients with pulmonary failure, your GI bleeding patients who are literally have a hemoglobin of 4, anyone in whom the risk of revascularization actually outweighs the benefits of the revascularization. So with regards to the early initial, now their patient is on the floor, what is the internist supposed to do? Starting off easy, they should get aspirin and then aspirin indefinitely. This is a point of contention. The P2Y12 inhibitor is up front for patients with non-ST elevation ACS. It's a class one recommendation from the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology. And this is something that typically is not done. And the point of contention generally comes from two competing sources. So we know that there's a modest but real improvement in patient outcomes with upfront loading of a P2Y12 inhibitor. Again, it's modest level of evidence, B, so the evidence is there. It's a class one recommendation. But we have two competing entities. Number one, if you have to take the patient to surgery, because in non-ST elevation ACS, you have sort of a sicker patient population, there's more likely they're going to have to go to surgery or have multivessel disease. Your surgeons are not going to take the patient to the operating room unless they're unstable for 24 hours up to 5 days on washout of Plavix. On the other hand, you've got the hospitals also telling you, we want you to reduce your length of stay. You got to get these patients out of the hospital. Why are your patients staying so long for ACS? The national average of length of stay for hospital ACS is 3 days. Your patients are here for an inordinate amount of time, and part of that involves the Plavix washout. So typically, and in many institutions this is the case, Plavix or P2Y12 inhibitor is not loaded up front, especially in patients who are designated for the early medical therapy arm rather than the early invasive arm. But it is something that we should always think about. High-risk patients, elevated troponins, these sorts of things are very important. And prognostically, we have multiple trials that go into, and the Plavix, most of the reduction was in recurrent ischemia, but with drugs like Brilinta, which actually takes a lead role in non-ST elevation ACS management, there is a defined mortality benefit, as was seen in the PLATO trial. It's about 1% absolute risk reduction of all-cause mortality. Again, that means you have to treat 100 patients to prevent one death by giving this medication, and it does increase the length of stay. So there's a lot of contention around this specific recommendation. The glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitors, again, if you have high-risk patients up front who you're trying to medically manage just prior to their acute coronary syndrome, this is a very reasonable thing to do. You could do it, but again, you better do it with qualifications. If you're giving someone a glycoprotein 2A3B receptor antagonist, you better have your cardiologist doing it, because this is something that's higher risk of bleeding, and if they do have to go for invasive therapy, they're much more likely to bleed after receiving this. Oh, look, we have a surgeon here who will pimp later on his thoughts on clopidogrel up front in non-ST elevation ACS. All these patients should be anticoagulated with short-acting anticoagulants, class 1 recommendation for almost everything. Unfractionated heparin remains class 1. Enoxaparin remains class 1. Bivalirudin, which is one that few people actually use unless there's heparin-induced thrombocytopenia history in the patient. One thing that I would caution people on, and I think any of those three is fine up front for PCI, but if you are going to choose one of the non-unfractionated heparin-based strategies, while fundoparinux is actually a class 1 recommendation, it does change what we have to do in the cath lab, and I think there's an increased risk of bleeding related to that, so I would sort of stick with the other three, either bivalve, Lovenox, or unfractionated heparin. And from a standpoint of an internist, really Lovenox and unfractionated heparin are the easiest to give. Effient. This was the first the third P2Y12 inhibitor, the first after Plavix, and there was a lot of promise for this, but somehow it didn't make it into the recommendations for being upfront use of antiplatelet therapy and non-ST elevation ACS. And you might ask why, because there's a good reduction in the number of events. And there's a couple of reasons, and I know a lot of people in BOCA may not qualify for Effient because of some of the contraindications based on age, so we don't usually see this drug very frequently around here. But in the principal TIMI 44 trial, they did look at this upfront for ACS. They randomized patients to Effient and Plavix. You'll see the patients who had Effient actually had decreased clinical endpoints, combined clinical endpoints, and did very well. The problem is that they had a much increased risk of bleeding. This was not seen in the PLATO trial with Brilinta, which is why Brilinta sort of got the recommendation in the guidelines. But again, it is useful up front, but it's because of the bleeding risk, and it's preferred to use Brilinta. So should you buy AstraZeneca stock? I would say probably about 3-4 years ago, this would have been really good because that's when Brilinta sort of took over the guidelines and became the drug of choice with the reduced clinical outcomes endpoints in patients with non-ST elevation ACS without a major increase in clinical bleeding events, which is important. The other good thing about Brilinta, which Dr. Kulik, who's here now, will tell you, is that while Plavix, you have to wash your patients out for probably about 5 days to reduce their clinical bleeding events if they do have to go to CABG. Brilinta is out of the system much sooner, so they may be more willing to take your patient at 3 days. He doesn't think so. the same sort of reduction in the clinical outcomes without the risk of bleeding. This is the diagrammatic of how you're going to take your patients through the initial ischemia-guided strategy and the early invasive therapy, and you'll see that the first box is essentially the same for both of these, the aspirin, the P2Y12 inhibitor, and then anticoagulation. In the early invasive strategy, they say consider the glycoprotein inhibitors. Again, I told you, you should probably at least make sure your cardiologist is on board with that before starting it, because this is probably a patient population that ought to go sooner rather than later to the cath lab. And then some of the guidelines do change post-stenting. So if your patient ends up going to CABG, the surgeons are going to change a lot of what's done, but you're going to discontinue Plavix or Brilinta 5 days before, Prasugrel 7 days before. These are your patients who are going to end up staying in the hospital for a prolonged period of time and increase your length of stay, which is why there are some issues and points of contention with the Plavix up front. If they do get stenting, all of a sudden the Prasugrel falls back into the guidelines as something you can use, but I think the kiss of death with this was the upfront loading of either Plavix or Brilinta, and you're probably not going to change your therapy once the patient has gone to the cath lab. So think we've been through parts of this, but when your patient comes in and you're looking for the ischemia-guided pathway, again, this is your low-risk patient, you're going to admit them and you're going to watch them for 12 to 24 hours to see if they have any evidence of ischemia at rest or low levels of activity. And then these are patients that are going to be great for treadmill stress testing, as long as they don't have ST changes that are going to preclude the use of a treadmill stress test. A lot of patients that we see end up having EKG changes, those sorts of things, and so for those patients, you would use a modality with imaging. Around here, it tends to be pharmacologic because it's quicker, easier, takes less time in terms of the clinician actually performing the test, and is very sensitive. But you could also use stress echo. And then, you know, in certain cases, you could also use CT angio to look into these patients. And that's come a long way since these guidelines were published. And I'm guessing in the next set of guidelines, there will be more use of CT angiography in terms of risk stratifying the patients. For the patients that do end up going to CAF in the early invasive strategy, this is one thing that was new in the guidelines. It used to be a big no-no. You go in, you take care of the culprit vessel, you leave. You're not supposed to do multiple vessels at the same time. It is now reasonable to do that. You could, but you ought to have some qualifications. Generally, people with decreased ejection fractions, the sicker patients, you're going to want to make sure they have more blood flow. So from an interventionalist standpoint, I may be fixing more disease up front, but you still shouldn't be surprised if your patient comes out with culprit lesions only PCI, with a plan for staged PCI on the other vessels. We've already been over the antiplatelet agents, and if anyone has any questions about that, feel free to ask. I'm going to try and wrap up here pretty quickly. Again, important to ticagrelor over clopidogrel in the early invasive category. And then prasugrel is okay if not at high risk of bleeding. And high risk of bleeding with prasugrel includes age, history of stroke, and any number of other bleeding risk factors, a history of bleeding. 81 milligrams of aspirin is used in preference to the higher doses after PCI, which has been a change that's been in place since about the mid-2000s, but should also be emphasized. The use of higher doses of aspirin, the 325s, is actually contraindicated with drugs such as Brilinta, and so almost invariably the regimen has been made a lot easier by just everybody gets 81 milligrams of aspirin after the initial loading dose. And then you should keep the patients generally on P2Y12 antagonists as long as possible, as long as they can tolerate it from a bleeding standpoint. This was the effient should be avoided in patients with history of stroke. The length of duration of dual antiplatelet therapy is important to look at. In non-ST elevation ACS, unstable angina, and even ST elevation MI, all of these patients have a 12-month indication in the ACC/AHA guidelines. 12 months, unless for some reason they have to come off early because of bleeding or high risk. But there's no real guidelines in terms of how long after that should you leave the patients on dual antiplatelet therapy, although they are starting to infiltrate into the guidelines as a lower level. But when we look at the treatment of late stent thrombosis, so after 1 year and up to 30 months in the DAPT study, you'll see that actually continuing Plavix for up to 30 months will still reduce your risk of stent thrombosis again. It's a 1% absolute risk reduction at 30 months, so for that time period between a year and 3 years. So for about 2 years, you get about 1% absolute risk reduction in stent thrombosis, and you get about a 1% increase in bleeding. And I think that's on the next slide. But it is helpful, and I think that the take-home here is anybody who can tolerate dual antiplatelet therapy for 30 months without a bleeding risk should receive it. You see all of the patients do better in almost every category. And then the bleeding, you'll see, is about a 1% increase in severe bleeding and about a 2 to 3% increase in minor bleeding events. Now, back to when patients need CABG and sort of that point of contention, aspirin should be continued. Your P2Y12 inhibitor should be discontinued, and it should either be 5 days or 7 days, depending on the drug that you chose. Urgent revascularization can be done at 24 hours, but it is an increased bleeding risk. And then it may be reasonable to do CABG. Again, this is the you could, but you better have qualifications in less than that time period, but these patients ought to be the ones that are unstable because you're going to put them in an increased risk of bleeding. The remainder of the recommendations really go through and talk about discharge planning, cardiac rehab, long-term therapy. Every patient should be recommended for cardiac rehab, and we've already been through the 12 months of dual antiplatelet therapy and aspirin. I did receive a question from one of the residents recently about Kangrelor up front. There's no current recommendations for the use of Kangrelor as opposed to Plavix or Brilinta in terms of the use in non-ST elevation ACS. There's no data to support that use, and I would really say that if you're thinking someone's high risk enough that you need to have the P2Y12 inhibitor, but you're afraid they're going to need surgery, you really ought to be consulting with your interventional cardiologist. So, and this is the last slide, and then I'll open up to questions, and I hope I left enough time for everybody. Back to our patient who came in with non-ST elevation ACS, what antiplatelet therapy would be most appropriate in that patient? 65-year-old guy. Really, probably Brilinta would be where you would want to start with him, loading him with Brilinta. What could have been better done on the front end? I would say in this patient, and the slide's all the way back at the beginning, but you remember he had a troponin elevation. He had ongoing chest pain despite nitroglycerin. He had to get morphine in order to take care of that. This is a guy that probably shouldn't have been admitted to a medicine service and probably should have bypassed and gone to the cath lab because he needed to receive morphine. He was a higher risk for events and was probably in a risk category than when you gave him morphine of being higher risk for actual death at the end of the day. Antianginals in him, you know, the usual nitroglycerin, beta blockers were appropriate. And if he receives PCI, should it be a different antiplatelet agent? No. I mean, if you're loading Brilinta up front, it makes sense to continue that unless the patient has a problem with it. And then I'd love to open it up to questions, and I know everyone has questions, so I wanted to leave some time at the end of the talk. Yes, Neil.
So the guy who comes in and doesn't get intervention, should they still be on the dual antiplatelet drug?
1 year.
For 12 months?
Yep. Everybody. And that's categorical across the board in terms of patients. Everybody, and even in the ischemia guided strategy, they should all get, even with effective therapy, 12 months of dual antiplatelet therapy. Yes, Mitch.
I think there are studies comparing initial CABG with PCI. Would it make any sense to hold on to antiplatelet agents if somebody's going to the cath lab within the hour?
Within the hour, yes. And I didn't go over that topic specifically because I sort of leave that in the realm of sort of the emergent patient, the ST elevations or the non-STEMIs with ongoing chest pain. But most of those patients, we have very good data for loading one of the shorter-acting P2Y12 inhibitors on the table in the cath lab. And we also have the ability to use things like Kangrelor at that time, which is a short-acting antiplatelet agent, takes the place of Plavix until the Plavix load is able to take effect if you do end up going through PCI, but it's also easy to turn off in those patients should they need to go to CABG. Yes, sir.
Kind of a similar question. Let's say you have somebody and you give them therapy and it is effective, and then you stress them,
Leave them on it.
And
no, their stress is now positive, so now they go into the invasive category.
Yeah.
Well, your interventionalist generally is going to be okay with you with cathing patients on dual antiplatelet therapy, so you don't have to worry. I see a face. generally, we're very good about cathing people on dual antiplatelet therapy. The one thing that some people will be a little bit iffy about is if you're on a 2B3A inhibitor. The femoral approach is a little bit more tricky because of the bleeding risk. But in terms of dual antiplatelet therapy, we do PCI and things like that on patients with dual antiplatelet therapy all the time. Oh, crap. The bleeding risk is lower from a radial approach. The real benefit of a radial approach in terms of mortality comes during emergent catheterizations, ST elevation MIs. That's where you're going to see your patients actually show a mortality benefit, and it is likely related to the bleeding risk. Patients who come in with ST elevation MIs are much more likely to get 2B3A inhibitors on the table, much more likely to have higher bleeding times from and ACTs from the heparin or the bivalve, which most people had switched to in terms of the femoral approach. I tend to use the radial approach in everybody, and the reason I use it in everybody is, number one, patients seem to prefer it just because they're able to sit up a little bit sooner. But if I'm going to use a radial approach in a patient who's emergent, I figure I better damn well be good at it and fast at it, so I better have a lot of practice at it. Did that answer your question? Okay.
Is there any role for biomedicine in contemporary practice? Do you use it for P2Y12 testing or use Brilinta?
You know, there's, I think Brilinta as a first line agent is very good. 20% of patients are going to be unable to tolerate it, and we've seen many patients with many different symptoms. The side effects of Brilinta tend to mimic those of ACS and or your stress test. It interacts with the adenosine receptor, so your patients will have shortness of breath. Some of them will have chest pressure, nausea. Anything that you might see during stress test or ischemia can be mimicked by Brilinta. In the early days, we saw lots of patients going back down to the cath lab for presumed stent thrombosis who had open stents. So you will have a lot of patients who are unable to tolerate the Brilinta. In those cases, Plavix is a very reasonable approach. The data behind P2Y12 or testing for Plavix resistance really goes through generally platelet function studies and things like that. There's really been no great clinical outcomes data to suggest that platelet testing is helpful in the end. And most of the studies out there show that if you give a 600 milligram loading dose of Plavix, you will be able to overcome the Plavix resistance in patients up front. I got two.
How do you deal with the atrial fibrillation patient who is fully anticoagulated on an ONAC or a Coumadin and then presents with a non-ST elevation MI? Do you still load them with Plavix? Do you still go ahead and do the dual antiplatelets after intervention?
You can. I mean, most of the data out there, and this hasn't reached level class one indication yet, but most people will look at these patients and sort of make a judgment call based on their bleeding risk. If this is an older patient, most of us will pare down our therapy to the novel anticoagulant and whatever your P2Y12 inhibitor is, your Plavix or your Brilinta. Up front, I'd give them everything they need. You know, if they're on a anticoagulant, let the anticoagulant wash out. When it's time for that to be out, you start them on unfractionated heparin, but give them the aspirin, give them the P2Y12 inhibitor, although We'll touch base with surgery back there and see what they have to say about that. But all of these are appropriate up front. Remember, if this patient starts to bleed at that point, we're talking about them being in the hospital, being well monitored, and having access to blood and transfusions if it's needed. You can replace blood. You can't replace myocytes. And also from that standpoint, most of what we're worried about with these patients is longer-term therapy. It's generally presumed to be fairly safe to go with a anticoagulant plus single antiplatelet therapy, especially in higher-risk patients out for a year. And it's done by most of us, unless it's a young, otherwise fairly healthy person who just happens to have atrial fibrillation. We may do triple therapy in that patient. There's no minimum amount of time. Again, this is sort of a gray area because it hasn't made its way into class one recommendations. But again, for the higher risk patient, I would probably err on the side of an anticoagulant plus single antiplatelet therapy. There are a few studies out there which won't apply to this patient population because they're being done in stable patients, but looking at the new drug-eluting stents and stopping dual antiplatelet therapy at 1 month, especially in elderly patients, probably about 2 years out from the data coming out from these so-called short DAPT trials. But it will certainly be enlightening for us here in Boca, where all of our patients tend to be over the age of 80. Yes, sir.
And
well, my ongoing joke is that Dave Lehman actually orders specific tubes that have troponin in them to help with. sorry, Dave. with the advent of the new very high sensitivity troponin assays, it does become difficult. Is there any set cut point? Again, patients with a peak and a trough that goes over the 90 percentile with typical symptoms, EKG changes or echo evidence of wall motion dysfunction, these are patients that, again, you're going to say are sort of having a non-ST elevation MI. Now, it gets tricky when patients have renal failure, when the sort of troponin sits sort of stable at a low level. And there was actually a retrospective analysis done in the Swede Heart Registry, which involved all of the hospitals in Sweden, looking at the new advent of the high sensitivity troponin assay. And there's a gray area where the troponin level is prognostic of poor outcomes, but not of ACS. And it's sort of in that low level elevation, but not really this peaking and troughing. These patients are not going to do particularly well in the long run. These are patients that have other comorbidities. They're doing poorly. They have renal failure. Maybe they have chronic stable angina. Maybe they're in with sepsis, those sorts of things where patients will have these elevated troponins that are not particularly not particularly predictive of acute coronary syndrome, but may be representing an underlying disease state. I hope that answers your question. I know it was sort of a politician's answer, but... I don't think the Melbourne study affects interventional cardiologists because it looks at stable disease, primary prevention, and an elderly population. I think that it's actually somewhat helpful for saying, yeah, if I have an 80-year-old person who has no history of coronary disease come into my office, starting him on aspirin may not prevent him from dying over the course of the next 10 years. But in terms of patients who have known coronary disease, are younger, have stents in place, there's no room for argument in terms of the benefits of aspirin.
Except they all want to stop it anyway.
Except they all want to stop it anyway. Yes, this is true. They're all convinced that the aspirin, not the Eliquis that they've been taking for years for their atrial fibrillation, is what's making them bruise. Oh, yes.
European guidelines don't actually recommend beta blockers, and there's some mounting evidence that we should probably Mm-hmm.
Again, it sort of depends on your patient population. The European guidelines tend to be much further ahead of the American guidelines, but they also tend to backtrack more frequently than we do. I think that in patients who have cardiogenic shock, have evidence of instability, the beta blockers are probably not a great idea up front. I mean, when people used to come in with ST elevation MIs, and Dave Lehman will tell you this, it used to be they get to the ER, they get 3 doses of 5 milligrams IV metoprolol up front before the interventional cardiologist has even entered the building. We've gone far away from that because of the risk for cardiogenic shock and things like that. But there are years and years of data about beta blockers and their beneficial effects in people. And I think that to deny therapy to 90% of the population for 10% that may have an issue with the beta blocker up front is the wrong thing to do. Along those same lines, we do need to be selective. We need to look at the patient. We need to say, okay, this guy's got a pulse of 50. We probably shouldn't be giving a beta blocker up front, even though it's a stable pulse of 50, because in the setting of his ischemia, he may actually need that cardiac output. Good. And now I'll put Dr. Kulik on the spot about his thoughts on upfront use of a P2Y12 inhibitor prior to cath in patients with non-ST elevation ACS. I know from a surgical standpoint, it makes your job a lot harder. Should we be doing it? It is a guideline-directed therapy that tends to be a point of contention because of length of stay and risk during surgery. So I think that the landscape will change in the next several years. I'm pretty sure there's going to be trials coming out looking at Kangrelor up front, which is a nice on-off P2Y12 inhibitor. So hopefully that'll be something that'll sort of clarify this issue. Maybe patients come in, they get Kangrelor up front until they're cath, and then they get told, yes, either we start a P2Y12 inhibitor orally or go from there. So hopefully that'll be resolved for you in the next several years. All right.